know this? It's a classic already. And it hasn't even come out yet.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. One unforgettable night. June 30th at the Orpheum Theater. Tickets on sale now at all Ticketmaster locations and Ticketmaster.ca. New albums, live from KCRW and Push the Skyway, available now.
On Jubilee Street, there was a girl named Bee.
For more info, visit nickcave.com.
She had a history.
How you feeling?
CITR presents DJing 101.9. We offer people a way to learn about the fun of mixing, sharing music, and throwing events. Our workshops and studio access is free for students and members. No experience or turntables are necessary. Workshops from 4 to 8 p.m. are on Tuesdays in 212A in the Student Union Building at UBC. For more information, visit us at citr.ca or follow at CITRDJ on Twitter.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 22nd of November. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our podcast and newscast on CITR.ca. In light of the recent typhoon in the Philippines, on today's show, we have a special panel discussion about relief aid and its implications. We're joined by, Jan Ludart is not here currently, but we do have Eliza Datar and Francis Arevalo, as well as Emily
McCants,
and Will Groot,
yes.
Who are all involved in the night with the Philippines.
Later in the show, we will be joined by Nina and Josh, who will be presenting on a recent rally, as well as covering the March to Reclaim Consent, which is literally happening right now on the UBC campus. If you run, you can probably make it to the statue of the Goddess of Democracy out in the courtyard between the Sub and Brock Hall.
Before we begin our first discussion, we'll just provide some background on what's going on in the Philippines. So on November 8th, 2 weeks ago today, Typhoon Haiyan hit the eastern seaboard of the Philippines, causing enormous destruction and loss of life. The storm had winds ranging from 235 kilometers an hour up to 275 kilometers an hour, with 6 meters storm surge. Although 800,000 people were evacuated prior to the storm hitting, many of the evacuation sites could not withstand the strength of the storm. And right now, the death toll is estimated to be sitting around 5,000 people, with 1,611 people still missing. And 4 million people are currently homeless.
Although Canada has contributed more than $40 million in aid to the Philippines to date, aid has been slow reaching the hardest hit areas due to damage to roads and other local infrastructure. Two Griffin helicopters were dispatched on Sunday to reach the region, and this Monday, Stephen Harper promised more funds to help with relief efforts, including water purification units. Canada's contribution to aid after the 2004 tsunami struck Asia was roughly 425 million, according to news coverage at the time, and Canada committed a total of 130 million in aid after a 2005 earthquake in Pakistan, according to a government estimate.
Here in studio with me, as I've previously mentioned, we have Eliza and Francis. We have Dr. Will Groot, who is the director of Rose Charities. We have Emily, as well as Alex, Sarah Davis, and myself. Everyone, welcome to the show. Just to open up the discussion, if everyone can go around, introduce themselves, and briefly explain their positions on or involvement with the aid relief to the Philippines. We'll start with Will.
Hi there. Yeah. Well, I am a director of Rose Charities, which is a homegrown BC organization that we've been in existence now around 12, 13 years. And we have a fair amount of experience with international relief work. We do steady state projects. Our main aim is to help where we can. We don't have a huge team of emergency people sitting and waiting. But when something happens, we try and just see if there is somewhere we can help. I might just say you only introduced me as director, but Emily is also a director of Rose Charities.
Very sorry about that.
Yeah, we have a number of directors. And so our team is now working there at the moment, and perhaps we'll have a chance to discuss a little bit more about that later.
Definitely. Emily, if you would like to.
Sure. Well, really, going on what Will said, I'm also a director of Will's Rose Charities, and we are currently helping in the Philippines now.
Okay. Francis?
My name is Francis. I am a fourth-year English student here at UBC. My role with the Night with Philippines is a co-coordinator with Eliza, who you'll hear from shortly. A Night with Friends is an event that I started with a bunch of other friends and other artists about 3 years ago. And it started sort of with 20 people gathering in a room, making music and putting a show on together into what it is hopefully in 2 weeks, which is a big community gathering of people celebrating the Filipino spirit and the resilience in the face of adversity.
Okay, and Eliza?
Hi, so I'm Eliza, and I am co-organizing A Night with the Philippines with Francis. The idea kind of sprung, 10 days ago? Just sending him a Facebook message, and knowing Francis, knowing me, it kind of just blew up into this thing, and we're really excited to raise money, and we trust in Rose Charities, and that everything is going to go to the right place.
All right, thank you. I think the first question we have for you guys is, do you think that Canada has adequately responded with our aid?
That's a pretty complex question, and actually you've come up, and it's a great question, you've come at it from a number of points of view. I mean, one thing that always strikes me, there's always rather an obsession with numbers, 20 million, 30 million, 40 million. Actually, really, a lot of that does not translate to what happens and what's being done in the field. You can throw large armies of equipment and transport systems at a country, but often it doesn't get through. For example, Haiti a few years ago, everything was just gummed up at the airport. You had to use lateral ways of getting in. I come from a slightly cynical, I suppose, point of view, so I have to be a bit careful what I say. Our organization tries to just work almost despite what goes on at the upper levels, because we realize we can do an awful lot with a relatively small amount of funding if you have the right networks. And not to be a show to kind of promote our organization, because there are a lot of really good organizations out there. But just to give an example, when something happens, we see immediately if we can link in with a local group and a local network. And then it's unbelievable what can happen in terms of getting equipment and materials to people without all this massive spending that goes on. So yes and no. I mean, it's a nice motivation. It's much nicer than some other countries haven't really helped at all when they could have. So it's nice that Canada's done it. But also there's a little bit of qualification there. And there's also people keep on going on about matching funds. And that really is a bit of a non-event as far as we're concerned. Matching funds don't actually, whatever the government says, don't actually come to the organization. They get given back into a government system, which essentially is CEDA. So you never see it. If you give me $20 for our organization to give to someone in terms of food, we're not going to get another $20 on top of that to give more food. So I think in a way that's slightly misleading myself. But the others may have a different view on that. So
does anyone else want to weigh in on?
I've silenced everyone of my citizens. Argue.
So, an interesting point about international aid, but is this in response to the fact that Canada so far has committed less in terms of numbers than it did in previous disasters, or...?
Are you asking me my opinion? No, I think the numbers game is, as I say, I don't really think much about it, whether it's 40 million, whether it's 50 million, whether it's 20 million. I'm much more concerned at our level as to how that money is actually being implemented and spent. I mean, to give an example, when the Sri Lanka tsunami happened, our organization collected about $100,000, and we're still there. We've implemented... I've got to be careful because this is not supposed to be a sort of polishing our organization. Other organizations are great as well, as I say. But we've implemented medical programs, we've implemented counseling, education, now leading on to microcredit. We're still there. We don't rush in and out.
It's long-term.
It's long-term. And that's... But going back to the current situation, for example, we realized early, well, we realized along with everybody else, that like water purification was needed. We had a contact in Indonesia that makes water purification systems for developing countries. And getting linked in with them, they said, oh, great, we would love to be able to donate something to an area. We knew where it was that they could donate to. So they've got 100 purifiers in. Now 100 purifiers each can... purify water for 200-300 people. So we're probably dealing with about 100,000 people. That's actually cost Canada nothing. It's cost us nothing. It was the generosity of another organization. But it was that link that made it. And so I think it's very much about links. And because everyone wants to help. Everyone's good-hearted, you know, whatever level. So, that's numbers, you know, whether we're talking 40 or 50 million, whatever.
Yeah, Francis or... Eliza, do you guys have anything to weigh in on that? Like, cause I know that you guys are doing a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So what are you, how are you expecting to use the funds that you get? Are you donating to a larger organization or are you doing it independently? Or through Rose Charity?
Rose Charity. Yeah. And we do need some funds. Come on. I'm not saying we need none. We can't operate on none. So, but we do, once you... I don't want to all talk again, but basically once you establish the pipeline and the networks, whatever you feed into it is going to be effective at the other end. Mm. If you feed $20 in, if you've got the system there, you're not using those funds to try and get your army of whatever you need to get in.
Mm-hmm. It's already there.
It is. But there are cases in the world where you need that. You know, the Somali refugee situation, Kenya, you need a big logistics. We couldn't do that. You know, these big on it can do that with large amounts of money. So, you know, it's a mixed field. It's a mixed field. But
with given like the nature of the time sensitivity and that like we can't like plan for 2 months and expect to sort of give the aid right away. By having an established organization like sort of at our fingertips and like in our networks already, it was so much easier just to leverage their power basically. Instead of trying to find our own cause and reach out to other groups, especially and trying to find our own local groups. So exactly what Will said about finding a pipeline and then just working off that already. So then we can put all our manpower into organizing the event itself and raising the funds. In terms of how we want the funds to be used, I don't speak on behalf of everyone, but my opinion is that as long as it's going directly to who needs it, and not being mixed up in this whole big numbers game and it being spent in places it doesn't need to be going to, that's sort of my biggest priority.
Yeah, no, I agree with that position in general. So do you think that these more grassroots sort of organizations are a better way to get relief to these countries than, say, the Canadian federal government?
I think that's a loaded question. It can't be answered in sort of like a yes or no kind of thing, and
we've got some time if you want to elaborate.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, it's also hard to quantify better. Like, what does better
more really effective?
Mean? I think it kind of depends on what the grassroots organization is doing. For us, it was really important when we decided to do this fundraiser that we meet the actual charity and the board member and kind of invest our trust in them. And you know, putting a face to a charity name really makes a difference. When you think about bigger organizations and charities, Red Cross, whatever it may be, there's a lot of overhead fees that goes into that. There's a lot of admin costs. And what we really admired about Rose Charities, and I'm sure a lot of other smaller grassroots charities, is that they don't have that large admin cost. You know, these are people volunteering their time. You know, the money we make
only a very small portion of that amount is actually going to go back into Rose Charities. The majority of it is actually going to go to on-the-ground work, on-the-ground resources, and we know that they have people on the ground currently at the moment who can kind of report back. And, you know, the needs 5 days after the disaster might change, a week after, 2 months after, 6 months after. And having some ears and grounds where the situation is at kind of helps us leverage our resources. And we trust that Rose Charities or whatever charity is going to make sure that our funds go to the right places.
Can I just add something there? Yeah. I've seen over the years, I've been in this business world about 20 years or so, and I've seen over the years there has been a shift away from government assisting smaller charities. I shouldn't completely go the other extreme. It shouldn't be just the small charities, because there is a role. There is a role for the big charities as well. You know, the large logistics, it has to be there. So I mean, I'm not that cynical. But it's very difficult now as a small charity to actually get in and somehow link in with kind of government mechanisms. For a start, you have to be a certain size, and there's vast amounts of sort of paperwork and the logistics of actually getting involved become too great. And it used not to be like this. But if you actually look at effectiveness, you will find, you know, in terms of input of a dollar going to help a particular person or a particular community, you will find that the smaller charities are more efficient. And that's not to pat the smaller charities all on the back. As I keep on repeating, there are needs for the large charities with large logistics are needed. But there's also a role, and it's a very valid role and actually a very effective role for the smaller groups who are right down there at grassroots level. And I think the implication of your question is, has there been too much move away from those charities? And mm-hmm. I would say absolutely. If it could be shifted back in the other direction, whereby there's more linkage and more help for the smaller groups, I think will be hugely beneficial for not only people in the field, but actually for Canada and Canada's good name in the world.
So, right. Well, just to go off of that then, to what extent do you guys think that foreign aid should be provided to countries? Like, do we have the responsibility to intervene, or should we be avoiding intervention in certain, you know, situations?
Okay. Well, it's very topical, and again, a difficult question or a complex question, because I mean, there are one viewpoint is that one shouldn't be delivering aid at all, and you know, there have been books written about it. It slips my mind, this particular one I'm thinking of. On the other hand, you know, if a country runs into a terrible situation, whatever it is, whether it's social, whether it's catastrophic, We are all one in an integrated world, and it's, even just looking selfishly, it's going to affect us here in some way or other, whether, you know, if it's a catastrophic war situation, we're going to get immigrants here. We're going to get people understandably desperate to leave their country and come to another place. So, and the same with disease and with environmental disasters, we're going to see the environment here. So there's, even if you just take selfish reasons, there's very much a need to help in situations, apart from simple compassion, which is a huge reason in itself. So, absolutely, I do think, you know, there's a need.
Yeah. I do think we also have to be very cautious. So when we are distributing aid, especially in developing countries, corruption is a huge issue. But again, if you do your research, you know, there is a benefit to aid. Mm-hmm. Just going off of that again, I mean, playing devil's advocate, does sometimes aid come off as seeming a little patriarchal? Like, we're providing aid in the way that we deem it necessary, as opposed to, because I know there had been a big call from the Filipino government earlier in disaster to give funds directly to the government. Emily, do you have any comments on that?
I was reading an interesting article the other day. It was about Bill Gates' billionaires club or something, where to join this club you had to be worth $1 billion and be willing to give half of it away. And they were talking a bit about some moral hazard there, that there were these people who had, say, at least $500 million to give away, and they could really make some significant changes in the world with that money, whether or not it was, you know, the wisest place to use that money, and maybe they were investing in what they thought was a good charitable endeavor, but maybe wasn't the most positive. So it's really an interesting thing to think about. You know, our governments have lots of money, these individuals have lots of money, but are they the best, do they deserve to be able to make those investments? And the question is, or the answer is, I guess, you know, we do our best to figure out what is a good charitable endeavor to go after, but you never really know until, you know, 20 years down the road whether or not it's been a good investment.
But it is terribly linked with political agendas and social agendas and community and even corporate agendas as well, if you really delve into
yeah.
it. I mean, it's the thing is riddled with with foxholes. I mean, it's... So you just have to be very careful, as Emily says, where it goes and how it's being done and what agenda is being followed, if any.
So to take this back to the government of Canada, do you think that, I mean, I think we can all agree that it's a good idea to do something about these sorts of things. Do you think that the government of Canada is the right group to be doing something about it? Do you think that it's important for them to be involved, or do you think we should be leaving it up to these smaller organizations?
No, well, I think the government Canada should be involved. Yes, but at all levels, I think it increases Canada's standing in the world, and you argue, well, why should one particularly want that one way or the other? But it's nice. I think it's a good thing if people see Canada as perhaps it used to be more as the peacemaking country, the country that does help others in the world. I personally, without getting political here, I personally don't particularly like the way we've gone in Canada in the last sort of 20 or 30 years or so. And I laud the fact that Canada goes out of its way to help and supply funds. I mean, the devil then is in the details, as with a lot of things, and how it's done and whether it's cost effective and whether there's a political agenda, and that's a whole debate which one could talk about for a long time. But I mean, yes, I think it's countries very much work, to my mind, as human beings. You know, if you're in desperate need, it's nice to help you. It's nice to be able to do what you can to actually help you. And similarly for you to if I was in deep need, it would be very nice if you helped me. So, yeah, that's my view. I don't know if...
Yeah, I don't... I mean, so here's the question. If Canada as a government should be...
Yes, or whether it should be things like Rose Charity who, they're long-term and they're grassroots, whether that is the more appropriate way to give aid.
I don't think the reason I'm having trouble answering the question is that, like, I don't think there's one that's more appropriate than the other, because, like, there are so many different ways that you can offer help.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's a fair response.
Yeah, I think, like, there's so many different, for example, like, a smaller charity would probably be better at A, B, and C, and then while a bigger organization, for example, the Canadian government, is better at X, Y, and Z. So I think, like, there's a wide range of things that different organizations, different sizes of groups, different... standings of groups can be better at, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
On that note, I'd like to ask Will, based on your experience, what do you think of the fact that Canada has sent 2 helicopters to help with the situation? Because do you think that donation is more helpful than just money? Or do you think, I mean, how important has transportation been in this sort of situation?
In this case, it has been very important, and I don't specifically know what the helicopters are being used for, but I would say that it sounds to me like it was a very good intervention. The only thing is, perhaps we could have got the helicopters there sooner, because it was in the initial phase that a lot of distribution problems happened. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, it was, again, our organization was actually getting supplies out really early, when a lot of the media here were interviewing people saying they couldn't get supplies out. And the reason for that is, again, not backpacking, but local communications. There was nothing to stop one in a lot of places getting a truck, which is what our counterparts were doing there, filling it up with food and driving it as far as you could go and actually getting to an area. Now, we weren't covering hundreds and hundreds of miles and hundreds of villages, but we were getting it out to places where people were in need. And it's still actually happening. So going back to the helicopters, there are still islands, because our team now is out there, it's going around the islands in boats. There are still areas that have not actually been touched, even as I speak. And so, yes, I mean, provided the helicopters are being used correctly and wisely, which I'm sure they are. I mean, they're experienced people there. I think it's a very good intervention, maybe a lot better than some of the others, actually.
Now, Eliza, I was wondering if you had, if you could give any comments to whether people should be giving proactively or reactively, because I know that your fundraising right now is in response to the events in the Philippines. Do you guys ever do anything that is, prior to an event happening, or just for general aid?
This particular fundraiser is the first time that I, and I think I speak for Francis as well, have ever put something on like this big of a scale.
Okay.
I've been involved with like volunteering for stuff and being a part of like clubs that, go into West Africa and build houses and things like that. But for me, this really just came out of, this is really close to home for me. This is my people. Me and Francis are from that area that was affected. Luckily, neither of our families were affected. Okay. But, being a Gen Yer, we get this stereotype that we're complacent and we are not very, compassionate towards these things, and we're very, think for ourselves or whatever. And, of course, everyone wants to deny that, especially if you are the people they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But if I look back in my life, I think I'm 23, and I think of the people that I look up to, and they're people who started really young and who did things really big. And I feel like I have a good network to support me in this. And I reached out to that network the same way that Francis did. And it took this. Unfortunately, it took such a big disaster to kind of activate this. But I would rather it have happened now than to just look back and said, what did I do for this?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, putting this out to all of you, would you say that, giving aid has historically been a positive or negative force in the world? Emily, if you want to start off with that.
Well, in general, I would say it's definitely been a positive in the world. There are, as we were talking about before, there are instances where aid is misguided, where a lot of aid, you hear about it a lot, where millions go missing and no one really knows what happened to it. But for the most part, you hear more success stories about aid than you do about real failures, or at least, real detriments. There's a lot of wasted money, but there isn't a whole lot of ill will that goes into it. But Will's been around in this area a whole lot longer than I have.
Or just maybe he's more got cynical. More Well, aid is a concept, yes. But again, one has to be careful of just looking at the materials and the numbers game, because as Emily says, I think we'd all be horrified, and I don't have the figures to hand, if one could see how much goes wasted and how it goes missing. I mean, the billions that have been put in over the last 50 years, and still, I'm quoting this, there's still areas you can't get a sort of $2 mosquito net. People are still dying of malaria. Kids, and then that is one thing, again, why we don't rush. Well, we help if we can in our organization. But, I mean, we actually see emergencies as not just being like your natural disasters. I mean, there's so many emergencies out there. There's, kids dying of malaria, there's HIV, there's war, child soldiers. These are all emergencies. These have the same status to us as a humanitarian disaster, as an environmental disaster. So to answer your question, I don't want to get off the point. I mean, yes, absolutely, with aid, but we should look a little bit deeper than just the numbers, because money's terribly corrosive stuff. Too much money, and it starts corroding everything. We human beings get corroded by it. So a plea for the kind of social level, really, for me.
Yeah. Now, just sort of going off what Emily had said, do you guys, anyone in the room, really support providing, just material things, or is it better? Because I know, like Eliza, you'd mentioned, going to build schools and that sort of aid, which I would say is, it is proactive. There's no big, terrible thing that's happened to bring that, to fruition. But, do you guys feel like that is something that is effective, or is it better to provide, say, the funds for, or the means for local people to, do it themselves? Because I know that is often a much contested subject when we send you know, 12 or 13 Western, you know, Western university students. You fly them over to, you know, West Africa, and they build a school and then fly all the way back, and, you know, it's a big pat on the shoulder for them, but how much does that actually do for the community?
Hmm. I think if I was someone in need of something, whether it's a resource, a program, or a material, I would prefer if someone asked me what I needed rather than impose whatever they choose to give to me. Because then otherwise, like, for example, if I don't have, let's say it's food given to me, then if I don't have the adequate ways to take care of the food, to store the food, mm-hmm. or way to ration out the food between different community or something, then, like, what's the use to me? So I think a way to gauge if aid is successful or not, or if it's well-received, is if you put a call out to the community, specifically whatever community has been affected, and see the nuances of what would benefit whoever's there.
Right, and so that means really sustainable aid, mm-hmm. right? Like what you mentioned, like, you know, if they can't preserve the food, they can't stock the school, then it's not necessarily, you know, mm-hmm. the most effective thing.
Yes, it was. Oh, sorry.
just another thing to consider of donations in kind is that it's often developed countries sending things to less developed countries where those goods are available for a fraction of the price. Mm. And then you have the shipping costs, and you end up with these warehouses, particularly in these kind of disasters. You end up with these warehouses full of goods that no one knows what to do with. It's hard to distribute them. So a lot of the time, money is really the best thing that developed countries can send. But as Francis was saying, it really has to be directed to the right places. It needs to be, you need to really involve the people on the ground. You can't just be the white person going in and telling them what's best for them. It really has to be a community decision. You have to involve all levels of the community to figure out what they really need.
Yes, and I really agree with what you said, Francis, as well. It's very, very easy to go in with an agenda. Mm. As somebody gave an example, a village where they're getting water from a little stream up the road. An organization goes in with the point of digging a well. They say, well, actually, we don't really need a well, thanks. But, you know, no, we're here to dig a well, you know. Oh, could you do something about my mum that's blind with a cataract? No, we're here to dig a well, you know. It's like Martians arriving here and telling us, you drive too fast, we're here to make you drive slower. You know, say, well, could you do anything about pancreatic cancer or something, you know. And say, yeah, we can cure that, but we're not here for that. You know, we're here because we have decided you don't drive too fast. Yeah. So, you know, it's absolutely...
And maybe one way to address that would be, for example, if... You mentioned like a university organization sending students over to, you know, mm-hmm. build houses, for example.
Yeah.
Maybe one way to address that problem would be whoever's the contact person on the other side is not just the contact person. They're a liaison between the community and the organization giving the aid. But I'm not sure what the logistics of, like, actually doing that.
Yeah, is. But I mean, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah. We hear a lot also about people going in and building houses or building schools, and then a community will now have a beautiful school, but no teacher, no funding for a teacher, no funding for school supplies. Maybe the kids, you know, their parents need them to work, to build a livelihood, and they can't go to the school. So you really have to look at the whole picture when you go in and want to give aid.
Yeah, actually, when we went in, I went to high school in Ghana, West Africa, and when we went into the rural areas with a group of 10, 12 high school students to build a home, we were there for 3 days, we wouldn't even finish a house, and at the end of the day, we're actually causing more of a burden to the community because, you know, they have to teach us how to lay hollow blocks and how to make cement and all of these things. So we're taking away from their time where they could actually be building the houses themselves more efficiently. And in the end, you know, I feel like the students who went in there got more out of it because, you know, we got to be more grateful about the lives we get to live and all this feel-good stuff. But in terms of the actual community that we were supposed to come in and help, really we were doing the opposite.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one of the things that I'm wondering, sitting here as a UB student myself, is I'm wondering, what are the best ways that I can help? I mean, it's been made clear to me that I shouldn't be flying anywhere to go, you know, work in one of these situations, but what can I do? I should be, I mean, I'm already paying taxes, but what else?
Good question.
I think what Francis and Eliza are doing is pretty great, you know, putting on a grassroots fundraiser, figuring out a really great place to donate the money. That's a great thing that students can do.
Yeah, I think it's really important to find out, you know, first of all, what is it you're passionate about? What is it that you want to change or affect? And then finding a charity or an organization that'll help you, you know, kind of be the vehicle to affect that change. And then doing something about it, you know, whether, you know, me and Francis are passionate about music, so we're putting up a concert. You know, I'm passionate about rock climbing, so I could ask all the rock climbing gyms in Vancouver to put on, a fundraiser competition. It's really, you kind of find your passions and kind of align them, find your networks, make it happen. It's a lot of work, but it's not that hard if you're passionate about it.
Yeah, and in addition to finding your passion, it's leveraging your strengths, because it's like, if there's a big learning curve, for example, if I wanted to put on a hockey fundraiser, I don't even know how to play hockey. I don't even know what's involved with the equipment. I don't know how to go book an arena, like all that sort of stuff. But I know how to put on a concert. So it's that much more effective, I guess, and more efficient when it's not extra work to put on an initiative.
Can I qualify? If you're going to get me hanging off the Scorbush chief or something on a rock climbing, forget it.
I'll leave that for myself.
I would say, though, just go back to, yeah, but you're just by having a discussion like this, mm-hmm. is great. It's airing a lot of issues that really should be thought about. It's so easy to just switch on the radio and you hear somebody saying, yeah, we're doing this and that, and we're doing this and we're all this in the area. But here you're actually discussing it and actually thinking about these issues. I think that's terrific. I think that helps a lot.
I think even more so than discussing the issue, I think it's challenging the issues. Like, this is the first time, I've put on a fundraiser before. And I know this is the first time that I've thought in depth about the way that I can contribute to fundraising efforts. So to be asked the questions and sort of having to, like, rationalize why I'm doing this, why we're doing these things, is help in itself. And I mean, maybe this is what we do for 40 minutes. But outside of this, it's a matter of looking at your networks, seeing what strengths you already do have, again, talking to more people, connecting with other people, and seeing what you can do as a collective rather than one person trying to push all the buttons and try to do everything yourself.
Right. Well, thank you guys very much for coming in. If you guys want to just quickly plug your event, and then we'll wrap this up.
Sure. So this event is called A Night with Philippines. It's in collaboration with Rose Charities, these folks to our right, I guess. It's a fundraising concert with incredibly talented. I'm gonna make this claim right now. This might be the most talent under one roof that you'll get. You'll have to pay $10 to come and see. I'm gonna make that claim right now, and I don't feel like I'm stretching or bragging in that sense.
Okay.
So December 5th. It's a Thursday. The event starts at 6:30. It's at the Croatian Cultural Center. For students and seniors, it's $10, and $15 for everyone doesn't fall under those categories.
Okay, and we will also put that on our Facebook page. And Will,
I just
want Emily?
To give our website.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Which is Rose Charities, that's plural, CHARITIES. And you can put CA, or you can put org, or you can put net. Net is actually probably more the bloggy one that's getting out the information. And then we have two Facebook sites. Rose Charities is a group. Everyone's welcome to join. Everyone who's serious is welcome to join, because you do get some strange people. And Rose Charities, two words, is our page. Okay. So
and yeah, we'll hook that up as well.
Thank you very
so
much.
So thank you guys for coming in. And for our listeners, we're going to have a quick PSA break, and then Nina and Josh are revving to go. So here we go.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner. Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dreams. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/teampowersmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart, and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Hello, Nina and Josh here. So we both went to the Enbridge Pipeline protest this weekend, and we just kind of wanted to give a little bit of a feel for what it was like. We found that it was more, what was really interesting about it was more of an event as opposed to a protest, which I found really interesting. Like the fact that there was face paints for kids, I don't know what you thought about that, Josh.
It was really made for everybody, very accessible.
Yeah. And there were some really, really good speeches. So, Josh, tell us a little bit about the interview we're going to play right now.
So I spoke to Ben West, who emceed the event, and he works with Forest Ethics, which is the main NGO behind the event. And I spoke to him over phone yesterday about how it went and some of the planning that went into it.
Here it is.
I'm here with Ben West, Tar Sands Campaign Director for Forest Ethics. So tell me a little bit about Saturday's event. How did it go?
You know, it was a really exciting event. It is hard to, you know, stand on a stage like that with, you know, over 5,000 people who are kind of on your side and not feel like we're going to stop this project. You know, it's one of the most controversial projects that's ever been proposed in British Columbia, the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. And, you know, this was one of the last opportunities for a big public show of opposition before, you know, the joint review panel makes a decision sometime before the end of this year. So we thought it was a very important moment to provide an opportunity for people to show their opposition. And, you know, of course, it was one of over 130 rallies that happened all across Canada, focused on climate change and tar sands pipelines. And the biggest one being this one here in Vancouver that, you know, I think was a big success and was a real testament to how concerned about this project people really are.
For listeners who might not be familiar with the company, can you talk a little bit about Enbridge itself and its operations?
Well, Enbridge is, you know, one of the bigger pipeline companies, you know, and increasingly they're becoming a company that is specializing in moving bitumen from the tar sands in Alberta, or sometimes called the oil sands. You know, of course, this is some of the dirtiest oil left on planet Earth. You know, as we're running out of conventional crude oil, we're shifting increasingly to even more difficult to access, dirtier, you know, more polluting and more greenhouse gas intensive forms of oil. And it's really just the wrong direction for us to be heading. You know, as we are facing the threat of climate change, you know, with folks in the Philippines and elsewhere, you know, demanding real serious action from countries like Canada, you know, our country is increasingly becoming a part of the problem instead of part of the solution. And, you know, pipelines like the Enbridge proposal, which would bring 525,000 barrels per day of this very dirty, very toxic oil, you know, through the Rocky Mountains, the coastal mountains, the Great Bear Rainforest, you know, crossing about 1,000 different streams and rivers on its way to, you know, the very treacherous coast of British Columbia. You know, it just would take us aggressively in the wrong direction, would actually facilitate an increase in the amount of oil that's being extracted in Alberta by about 30%. You know, so as we're, you know, supposed to be on a road to reducing our dependency on fossil fuels, this would actually move us towards even more dependency and on even dirtier forms of fossil fuel.
How long have you been organizing for the No Enbridge demonstration on the 16th?
We actually organized it relatively quickly. I mean, you know, it was the end result of years and years of work that, you know, we've all been doing on this campaign. And I mean, this is a campaign that's got a lot of momentum behind it because of, you know, a solid, you know, 5 years or so of many different groups doing a lot of work to raise awareness and to, you know, make sure that people all across the province are aware of what's going on. But this particular rally, it was actually only a little over a month, maybe 2 months before the rally happened that, you know, we finally decided, you know, all across Canada to organize a big event. And, you know, when you're coordinating with, you know, with literally hundreds of different groups all across the country, it's a difficult process to kind of get to a place where everybody agrees on the timing and the date and the name of the event and all that kind of thing. You know, so it actually wasn't really until so about a month before that we started to really, you know, work on it full time.
What is Premier Christy Clark's record on the issue?
Well, good question. You know, Christy Clark has kind of been on every side of this issue, and it's hard to really pin her down. I think she's actually been sort of flip-flopping on it. The government of BC, in its official submission to the Joint Review Panel process, which is really the most important statement of her position, you know, because that's the official regulatory approval process, you know, on behalf of all British Columbians, said that the Enbridge pipeline should not go forward, and actually based that on pretty sound science and an analysis of, you know, the proposal as has been brought forward by Enbridge. And, you know, I'd say most people would say it's fair to say Enbridge has really bungled the sales pitch on this pipeline. And, you know, and Christy Clark has reacted and has, you know, shown that BC is woefully under-resourced to respond to an oil spill and has actually commissioned a couple of reports that have shown that. But, you know, the flip side of that is we've also seen her just recently signing an agreement with the Premier of Alberta, which seems to, you know, kind of open the door to this kind of project going forward. So, you know, I think it kind of depends what day of the week and what news story you're reading, you know, to really get a clear picture from the Premier of where she stands on this project. But I still feel confident that, you know, that at the end of the day, the politicians give the permits, but the people give permission, and the people are not giving permission for this pipeline to be built. And, you know, if things go the way they should in a democracy, she will listen to the people of British Columbia and will not sign the permits that would be required to allow this project to be built.
And how confident are you that the public can stop this pipeline from going ahead?
You know, this is one of the strongest social movements I've ever seen. I think it might just be the social movement of our generation. You know, this movement to sort of turn the tide when it comes to these kinds of projects that make things worse for climate change. So there really is a growing global movement when it comes to doing something about climate change. And, you know, and right now that very much means stopping these kinds of pipeline proposals. And the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline has become a real symbol for that. It's about more than just this one particular pipeline. And for that reason, and sort of, you know, being close to it on a day-to-day basis, I really have a hard time imagining this pipeline ever gets built. You know, there's just so many people working in so many different ways, whether it be, you know, First Nations and legal battles, or, you know, people who are willing to get involved in acts of civil disobedience, or, you know, the various different people working within the regulatory process. You know, there's a lot of different approaches that are that people are taking on. But, you know, what seems consistent to me is that, you know, that we're just going to keep working until this project is stopped. And, you know, I think it really is just up to the politicians whether they want to do this the easy way or the hard way. And, you know, and the easy way is to simply just listen. And you know, in the regulatory process, there's thousands of people who commented. And, you know, the overwhelming, like over 95% of the people who actually made submissions, maybe even more than that, were opposed. And, you know, the evidence showed clearly that the pipeline shouldn't go forward. BC's submission said so. And, you know, you would think that the logical consequence of that is that the project would be abandoned.
Thank you very much, Mr. West. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too. Cheers.
So that was Ben West from Forest Ethics. So just a quick question, Josh, like after that interview with him, did you kind of have the sense that, you know, there's this good energy thinking that...
Well, listen, there's a really good energy for sure, and I felt that at the demonstration. And Forest Ethics is doing a great job with their campaign for sure. He's a great, I mean, he's been called like a great orator, and he is a really good speaker. But this does come as like 2 days ago, Globe and Mail reporting that there's actually a growing BC population in general has a growing favor towards Enbridge. So,
what was their reason?
Just like in a general poll, it's coming out that more and more BC residents are favoring the pipeline. So it's kind of, I mean, obviously this is coming from the Globe and Mail, but there is kind of, it's unclear.
Yeah.
It's unclear how this is going to play out.
Well, we know that there are a lot of people against as well. So that was Ben West from Forest Ethics. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with, we're going to be talking about the Night to Take Back Consent, which is happening right now at UBC. This is CITR 101.9 FM.
Need help keeping your skin healthy? Let Dermabrite Clinic bring out your best and brightest skin. Dermabrite Clinic offers a holistic approach using aesthetic services, blue LED light, a proper home kit, systemic analysis, and a complimentary holistic physician consultation. Plus, we offer a money-back guarantee and payment plan options. Dermabrite Clinic is also proud to sponsor several local charities and emphasizes sustainability and chemical-free practices.
For more information, check out Dermabrite Clinic on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Pinterest, and more. or check out our website at dermabrightclinic.com.
It's a stressful time of year, which means it's more important than ever to take good care of yourself. Take this moment to feel good. Follow along with this mini meditation and reduce stress quickly. Breathe in and hold for 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale slowly. Breathe in once more and hold for 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale slowly. Visit students.ubc.ca/feelgood for other ways to live well, feel good, and achieve success. Now that we've all meditated, we are back on CITR 101.9 FM. This is your CITR news team. So Josh and I, like true raw journalists, were just on the field 15 minutes ago at the Night to Take Back Consent. This was the event. We interviewed Laura Fukumoto last week about it, basically to get the background premise. This is obviously a response to the sexual assaults happening on campus, as well as a response to the Night Take Back the Night rally, which happened a couple of weeks ago, which stirred a lot of controversy. And as if anybody remembers from last week when we were talking to Laura, this was a different approach because there was just sort of a lot of controversy happening and she wanted to be a lot more organized. So
yeah, sorry, I just wanted to add that the March to Reclaim Consent, there had been some organizing stuff going on for that march sometime before the Take Back the Night. And the Take Back the Night was kind of a very, very speedy kind of...
process.
Yeah, it was very speedy. And it was kind of because the March to Reclaim Consent was originally, from what I've heard, originally planned for a later date. So the March to Reclaim Consent has had a lot more time to organize.
Yeah, and this is something that Laura was talking about, that the reason there were a lot of problems with, not the reason, but one of the reasons, was because it was very hasty. It was organized by two individuals, actually, not by the entire women's club on campus. So it was these two individuals who had kind of hastily put this on Facebook, and we all know what happened, and you can just go to the Facebook group if you want to see it. There's just a lot of controversy about it. So this was what we noticed today, me and Josh, were that it was like there was a lot less of a bang. There wasn't very much news coverage being just happening around it. But there was one man from CBC who was following the group as they are now marching right now around campus, who's kind of serving as their cameraman, who's getting all the speeches and he's getting people's opinions. But definitely, Josh, what would you have to say?
There was definitely... there was less of the energy, that kind of nervous energy, yeah, that was at Take Back the Night. That was noticeable. There was, you were saying, around 100?
There's around 100 people, and yeah, Take Back the Night definitely had more. But remember what we were saying about, there was just like, at Take Back the Night, there was this sort of air of uncertainty. Like, mm-hmm, no one's sure what this is, and no one's sure what it's going to turn into and what exactly maybe these people are rallying against. There were so many causes being thrown about that you could feel the uncertainty of a real, raw, we don't know what this is protest. This was a lot different. I know, what did you say, Josh? You were just like, I just feel organized right now.
It felt super organized. They were handing out little
leaflets,
yeah, with the lists of chants and what the chants were, which I found was, I mean, it, there's something to be said for sure about really strict and well organized protests like this. Definitely there's a lot of force that comes from that.
Yeah, and what I also noticed was that this time the speaker, which was primarily Laura, she had everything planned out. She had every speech that she was giving was previously written. She's gone over the speeches. She's like thought of every little person that she has to acknowledge. And so there was, I think in that way it was more structured as well. It wasn't just sort of blindly calling out. And I don't want to say that the other one was blindly either. They were definitely, everybody knew what people were trying to say, but the way that it was done made a lot of people angry.
It didn't seem like they were doing the open mic thing that they had at Take Back the Night.
Yeah. So we're just going to play a little clip with...
This is Jebet O'Reilly, who's attending the march as a UBC student.
This is what she had to say about being at the march.
Day, just so many people, and it's kind of terrible to think that I'm here on this campus to learn, and I should feel safe, and I don't. And I know this happens to so many people, and I think it's time that, as a group of students, we got together and started to say, we're not okay with this, we're not okay with this environment, and we don't think it's right.
Were you at Take Back the Night?
I wasn't at Take Back the Night. I'm not really entirely educated on what the process behind that event was, but there was a number of things about it that I didn't feel aligned with my views, and I didn't feel comfortable with going, even though I supported the general idea of taking back the night, reclaiming consent. I think.
So
that was Jebet O'Reilly.
What she had to say about the event, and I think that was the general sort of opinion feel. This next clip that we're going to be playing, there's a bit of a backstory. If anybody's been following this event, you know that there's been a lot of controversy. Arno Rosenfeld from the UBC published an article calling the Take Back the Night rally shameful. And there were many responses to this, and we actually caught up with him tonight. It was funny because at the last rally, Josh and I talked to him, and he kind of, after we had that conversation with him, he seemed really open to what was happening, and I guess then I got the impression from his article that it was completely different opinion from what I had gotten from him when we had met at the Take Back the Night. It was a funny moment today, Josh, when I realized that was Arno because yeah, I didn't even know it was him.
He definitely has a strong and very well thought out opinion about this movement that's kind of risen up. He's the feature editor at the UBC.
So in this interview, we'll just quickly play it now. It's just a quick little conversation I had with him earlier, about 20 minutes ago, actually. So very recently. Just saying that there was a little bit misunderstanding about his article and the way people looked at it.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's what I mean that I think it was partially misunderstood, and part of that's my fault. Part of my discomfort with some of the criticism was I really didn't feel like I could stand behind some of the things I said, because I said them in clunky ways, because I didn't say it in a cohesive enough way, and so like, some of that's to be expected. If you say something in the wrong way, people are going to misinterpret it, but yeah, I mean, I also think that I said a lot of things that were I said things that should have put me well on, I mean, if you want to put like a right-left spectrum.
Yeah.
I think I said things that should have been considered well to the left, but because of maybe a tone that I took, it was taken as something
extremely right.
Different.
So that was Arno. As you can see, I guess he was a little bit misunderstood, and what he had said to me after was that he really, like, what you could hear, that it ended up being a lot perceived as right-wing, whereas he was actually hoping that this issue, which he thinks is a very important issue, should be a really important issue, but for him the problem was that the activism, in his opinion, wasn't up to par for how big of an issue this was.
There was some four or so responses to the UBC to his article, which was some responses that were quite aggressive.
I think it's because it was he even says he used certain words, he used certain lingo that made it seem a lot more, I don't know, I guess you could say a lot more aggressive and anti-feminist in its nature. And so and one of the people who actually criticized him was Laura, who was the organizer of this event, and she was pretty open in the way that she was criticizing him, and I think she also knew. I asked him if he had had a conversation with her, and he hasn't yet, but I think that after realizing what he wanted to try and say, and after him seeing what she's trying to do,